My next guest argues that it's time to face the fact that we will never be rid of class. The German philosopher Hanno Sauer reckons Karl Marx was too optimistic by half. Revolutions only bring new hierarchies. Privilege never dies. And it's time, he says, we faced the fact. Hanno Sauer is speaking at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne on Thursday night and at Sydney's Festival of Dangerous Ideas this weekend. But right now, he joins us on Late Night Live. Hanno, welcome.
Hi, nice to meet you.
What did Marx get wrong?
I'm a big fan of Karl Marx and his writing. He's an aggressive, funny writer and very, very important. But by now, I think we have to admit that he got many things wrong. He got some things right, but many things wrong. And I think one of the big ones that I like to highlight is that Marx thought that, famously, he thought that capitalism is going to dig its own grave. And the reason for that is that Marx was somewhat paradoxically a big fan of capitalism as long as it's, you know, temporary. So capitalism, according to Marx, creates enormous wealth, enormous abundance, and enormous prosperity. It just makes, essentially, it makes everyone rich beyond imagination. And that is what dooms capitalism in the end, because the reason we have hierarchy and inequality and class structures in the first place is because there is conflict over scarce resources. And so once capitalism eliminates scarcity by creating enormous abundance, the very rationale for class conflict and class struggle, which ends up creating the social groups, classes, it withers away. And that's a big thing that Marx got wrong. We have seen over the past years and decades, over the past 100, 150, 200 years, that material abundance does little or nothing when it comes to eliminating social inequality, because human beings care not just about material well-being and prosperity, we care about our relative position in society. We care about our position in a ranking relative to our neighbors and our peer group and a comparison group. And that is something that cannot be eliminated by creating material wealth.
Why is this so fundamental to us?
There are many reasons. It has very, very deep evolutionary roots. So we are obviously a social species. We're not the only social species. There are social insects. There are, you know, most animals have some degree of sociality, but we are what's called hypersocial. We are intensely dependent for our survival and for thriving as individuals, as organisms. We are intensely dependent on other individuals, so we are hypersocial. And at the same time, something that's special about us is that we are, by nature, a cultural species. What that means is that almost everything we know, all our skills, all our knowledge, 99.99999% of what we can do and what we know, we have learned from others. It's been passed down to us either horizontally from people that are alive now or vertically from previous generations. And we download almost all our skills and knowledge from this accumulated cultural reservoir. Now, we are social learners, in other words, and social learning can't be random. Social learning has to be guided by various types of filters and sometimes called biases, but not bias in a negative sense. It's just sort of like, you know, non-randomly deciding whom to learn from.
Yeah.
And our most important proxy for deciding whom to learn from is reputation and prestige. So it's extremely deeply entrenched and ingrained in our psychology to be attentive to cues of social prestige. And these cues, they end up generating social hierarchies. And once human groups start to grow beyond 36 individuals, right, once we scale up human cooperation, there is an interaction between group size and prestige psychology that creates these social groups that we then call classes. And we've been stuck with that kind of society for the past, give or take, 10,000 years.
We discuss the evils of racism. We look at prejudices against women. We look at prejudices against gays. These are discussed. These are political issues. But in the most extraordinary way, class is not a political issue. We don't hear politicians talking about ways to address the unfair aspects of class.
Yeah, not as much as we would expect, right? Given how central socioeconomic inequalities are to people's lives and how their lives go. And so we've, over the past 5, 10, 15 years or so, we as a society have focused intensely on various types of disadvantage, inequality, and marginalization, racism, you mentioned, sexism, ableism, discrimination towards minorities of various types. And that discourse was legitimate. Not all of it was high quality, but in principle, it was a good idea to, you know, negotiate these things and to talk about them and to try to find new ways of addressing inherited past injustice. So all that was legitimate. But at the same time, there was this suspicion that people had that we are kind of missing maybe the fundamental thing that is most important, which is that we only care about skin color and race and sex and sexual orientation to the extent that it affects people's lives. Right? We only care about racism to the extent that it has socioeconomic implications. Right? We don't really care about eye color in the same way, because eye color doesn't really have these socioeconomic ramifications that skin color has. That's why we care about racism in the first place. And I think that classism is really the most fundamental category of social injustice and social advantage and disadvantage that we should be looking at. And it's the most important thing that we need to understand the mechanisms of and how it's generated, how it's sustained, how it's hidden, how it's defended by people that benefit from it. And my book is trying to develop a theory of where classism and class originates and why it's so insidious and troubling.
Do you think that there is a sort of assumption in Western democratic politics that we are inevitably moving towards a more equal society, and that that is what you most need to address, that kind of lazy assumption that we're on the right road?
I mean, to some extent, that is an assumption that we want to make, right? So the past 200, 300, 500 years, however imperfectly and however frustratingly, have seen many, many gains in a direction of more equality, right? Societies used to be much more unequal along totally illegitimate lines.
Indeed.
Aristocracy, disenfranchising women, slavery, you mentioned gay people, and so on and so on and so on. So many, again, far from perfect, but many of these inequalities have been mitigated, reduced, and in many cases even largely disappeared. And that's good. So in principle, the assumption that we want to see greater equality in society is a good one, but I think that we underestimate the power of class and status hierarchies, because the usual political levers and political means of intervention and of rectification of these class and status hierarchies don't really work.
Is there a complication here for your argument, which is that elites in the politics of the United States and in many places in Europe, there is this notion that the elites are evil, and that would seem to me to contradict your argument that there is a natural tendency in us to admire elites.
I mean, admiration is a two-edged sword, right? And I think it doesn't undermine my argument. In fact, I go into it in my work, which is that, of course, on the one hand, we admire and envy the so-called elites, but the people who don't belong to these mainstream elites, they would rather they did. And so sometimes they can develop the impression that the system is rigged against them, in some cases that may even be true-ish. And so they are incentivized to maybe declare themselves the true elites or the counter elites, and they try to, you know, topple the existing hierarchy in their own favor. So we do admire. We are inevitably. We cannot escape the power and the force of thinking about society in terms of prestige hierarchies and who's at the top and who's at the bottom and who's in between and where are we. But at the same time, that can come with resentment for those who perceive themselves to be threatened in their relative status. And that is, in fact, probably the main factor driving recent, you know, neoconservative or right-wing backlash. It's not so much about economic factors. It's more about perceived status threat and perceived loss of relative standing in society.
Are you arguing that there is always a kind of natural sorting of power and wealth into hierarchies? Or are these hierarchies artificial, illegitimate? Are they natural? Or are they illegitimate?
Well, they could be natural and illegitimate. Many things are natural but bad. Cancer is natural but bad.
Yes.
So in the same way, status hierarchy could be a natural thing, but something that is undesirable to have. The way I see it, I like to say that class hierarchy is a kind of socially constructed scarcity. So it's a kind of scarcity that comes into the world due to the way that human beings build their own communities and societies. So it's both. It's artificial in that these are socially constructed hierarchies, but we construct them out of material in our psychology and in our world that is natural. So it's both and neither. I would say, but either way, even if it were natural, or even if it were to some extent natural, that wouldn't legitimize it. I think we can still ask, do we want to have this? Is it good for us? Does it lead to a beneficial way of living for a great number of people? Or is it dysfunctional? Is it problematic? Is it unjust? I think class hierarchy is a kind of socially constructed scarcity. We use natural raw materials, but it's made up by us.
To get back to Marx, I mean, as you were saying, Marx had this notion that if you flooded the zone with wealth, there would be no class struggle anymore because everybody would have enough. But isn't the problem here that human beings have a very tenuous grasp of what's enough?
That's exactly right. So Marx was writing in the second half of the 19th century, in the early part of the second half of the 19th century, and a big hero of my book is the American economist Thorstein Veblen, somewhat lesser known economist, who published a book in 1899, so at the very end of the 19th century, that's called The Theory of the Leisure Class. And in this book, he coined the term conspicuous consumption. I think that's a term that maybe some people have heard. So the idea is that a lot of what we do economically and a lot of the things that we consume, we don't consume because they are necessarily practical, right? You don't have a sizable house staff because it's practical. You have a sizable house staff of 20 people and a butler and blah, 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 because you want to show off that you can afford it, right? So it's in the technical term for this is costly signaling. And human beings engage in a lot of costly signaling. We try to communicate certain latent, unobservable, but desirable qualities about us. And the way that we do that is by communicating them in a way that is difficult to pull off, difficult to do, just like the, you know, a wondrous peacock's tail is difficult to have for the bird. You know, certain types of, you know, expensive watches or a big house are expensive to afford, and that's how we signal our relative position and society. And that is one of the fundamental mechanisms that creates status hierarchy and status inequality in any society.
But isn't the business of signaling infinitely subtle? Because you also talk about the care with which many powerful people hide their wealth. They don't flaunt it. The signaling to the wider community about who really has the deep pockets and power can be kind of deliberately obscured.
That's exactly right. And in fact, it's one way in which signaling can be costly, which is that some people signal wealth by signaling that they don't need to signal it. And so they engage in a specific type of conspicuous consumption, which is inconspicuous consumption. But that is something that you must also be able to afford. So it's only some people who can afford to be subtle about their wealth and to not flaunt it. And that in itself is its own kind of power move.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Maher, and I'm talking to Hanno Zauer, who's the Associate Professor of Philosophy at Utrecht University. He's out in Australia at the moment for the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. And he is arguing, he can contradict me in a moment if I've got this wrong, he is arguing that we have to face the fact that class is with us always. Hanno, is that fair enough? A fair enough description of your motives here, that we have to face this fact?
Yes, it's. I don't think that's a defense of class society and status hierarchy.
No.
But I think it's an unpleasant truth to some extent and a sort of bitter pill to swallow. And the reason I'm saying this, I try to be very, very careful in explaining why I think that. So it's not supposed to be like, this is never going to work. We're never going to be able to eliminate that. But I try to very thoroughly explain why that is. And I think the main reason is that equality in human society and equality in human communities and groups has always depended on our ability to suppress and neutralize efforts to create inequality. Because even back in the day, hundreds of thousands of years ago, there would be efforts by some to declare themselves the boss or the chief or the wannabe tyrant or the best hunter or the best cook or the best storyteller. And in these small groups of a couple dozen members, perhaps, we would have mechanisms at our disposal to curb these efforts at creating durable social hierarchy. We would say, you're nothing, or, you know, even you know, all the way to murdering the wannabe tyrants, right, to maintain equality. And there came a point in human history, not that long ago, in fact. So for most of our history, we didn't have class structures. For most of our history, we had inequality and prestige hierarchy, but we didn't have durable, generationally transmitted class structures. This is actually fairly recent. So in that sense, it's not really part of human nature. It's more like an accident of fairly recent history that's a couple thousand years old. But at a certain point in time, we managed, due to cultural evolution and due to climate change also, the changes in the climate, we managed to grow ever larger groups of a couple hundred, couple thousand, maybe 10,000, maybe 50,000 individuals in the first early empires, early civilizations, early urbanization developments. And once you reach that group size, the mechanisms that used to allow us to suppress these inequalities, they become disabled. And that's the world we still live in. We just don't have any mechanisms, at least no morally and normatively and socially and politically tolerable mechanisms to suppress the kind of inequality that always keeps bubbling up in human society. We used to have these mechanisms available to us, but we no longer do.
I mean, one of the great mechanisms for establishing or moving towards equality is tax. Have we lost that as a mechanism for equalizing society?
I mean, we still have it, and none of my arguments have any bearing on the justification of taxation or redistribution. Much of that can be a good idea, and it can serve its purpose and be functional. But I think we are lying to ourselves when we think that taxation and redistribution are effective tools against status hierarchy. One or maybe two reasons for that are it's never going to be strong enough. Right, because status hierarchy only needs any degree of inequality, right?
Yes.
So if we tax away, if you have someone who has 10 billion and we tax that person down to 100 million, it's still going to be hugely unequal, and it's going to do nothing at all when it comes to the relative position of that person in society, and no one even comes close to proposing taxation that radical, or maybe some people do, but And the second reason is that in many cases, redistribution and taxation can backfire. So there is a lot of research on so-called welfare stigma, which is that being on the receiving end of measures of redistribution tends to be a status injury. So the things that we use to create more equality can inadvertently maybe create more material and economic equality, but at the same time, they can amplify symbolic inequality and status hierarchy. And so the traditional ways of making society more equal, like taxation and redistribution, don't work at all against status hierarchy and relative position in society.
Now, you argue very clearly that, you know, inequality is with us, you know, hierarchy is with us, they're here to stay. And you make the wonderful point that revolutions don't solve the problem, because in communist China today, you argue, don't you, that the old powerful families from pre-communist days are oddly well represented at the top of power.
Yes, and you see that everywhere. There's lots of research on, you know, you can look at text records from Renaissance Florence, and you see that people who used to, the families used to be wealthy in 1496 or something like that, they still tend to be wealthy in Florence today. You see that there's an extremely high degree of the heritability of socioeconomic status in the UK, for instance, over hundreds of years. There's data that the value of people's houses and their income are correlated in exactly the same way in which they are related to each other. So there's a very, very high degree of heritability of socioeconomic status. You see that in India. You see it in China, where there's economic data and economic studies being done, that even the most extreme attempt in modern times to suppress inequality, you know, the Cultural Revolution and so on and so on,
yes,
in communist China, did next to nothing when it comes to durably overcoming social inequality. And indeed, as you say, the elite families in China today, they are the descendants of the old elites from before the Cultural Revolution.
What's the relationship between social mobility and class? They are not exclusive, are they?
No, they're not exclusive. Different societies have different degrees of social mobility. I think in principle, having societies where social strata and social groups are relatively permeable is a good thing. So you don't want to have caste societies. You don't want to have an extreme degree of social classes being shut off against each other. So you do want social mobility on the basis of maybe you have a good idea or you study or something like that. So that's these are all well and good. Social mobility upwards, that is, right? You ideally don't want to have social mobility,
yes,
downwards. So it goes both ways, and you want the one kind but not the other. And I think it's also true that modern societies, say Australia or Canada or Germany, they are much more socially mobile than they used to be 200 years ago or 1,000 years ago. And that's good. And we should have more of that and encourage that and keep that. At the same time, people who belong to different social groups and different social classes sometimes also actively work against that, right? If my relative position in society is very important to me and how my life goes and how the lives of my kids go, then there'll be incentive. There will be an incentive for me to kind of be an enemy of social mobility, right? Because I'd rather stay amongst my own and keep these benefits and privileges to myself,
yes,
and the people that I like. And so social mobility is a good thing,
but
the mechanisms that generate class sort of act against that a little bit.
Except, one of the arguments for the one of the explanations for the durability of the class system in Britain is that it has always been willing to absorb new money. So if social mobility brings money with it, then that can be absorbed into the highest reaches of the aristocracy in Britain. I mean, mm-hmm, you know, the Dukes of Marlborough are living off the Vanderbilt railway fortune.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a way in which social mobility actually aids class hierarchy.
Yeah, there can be kind of there can be a kind of like implicit coalition between the old elites and the nouveau riche, and that solidifies certain types of class hierarchy. Certainly, you see that in the UK, you see it in other places as well. And so that's one of the many mechanisms by which elites keep their position by sometimes compromising about the origins of their wealth.
They're very good at defending themselves and their positions, aren't they?
Yeah, that's how they got there. in some cases.
Hello, it's how they got there. Yeah. Mm. Hey, look, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Hannah Zahr, who is out in Australia to speak on Thursday night at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne and over the weekend at the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. Details of his talks are on the websites for both those places. There's also a wonderful article he wrote setting out his ideas in March this year in The Philosopher's Magazine, which is online.